A writer by the name of Anthony DeMello tells a parable about a group of people who were on a tour bus together. They were gliding through the beautiful roads of Michigan during the October months of the year and looking at the extraordinary colors, the blazing colors, and the sun was shining, it was blue sky, the smells and the sounds of the beautiful fall were all around them, but none of them were noticing it. As the tour bus was going past beautiful rivers and lakes and extraordinary visions of beauty, nobody was noticing it because they were all turned toward one another having an argument. They were arguing about which one of them should have the seat of honor on the bus. Which one of them should get to sit in front of the biggest windows with the best views? And so they argued and argued as the tour bus went along. Well, change the names and places, and you're looking at two of the disciples of Jesus this morning. Our own tour through the Gospel of Mark leads us this morning to the 10th chapter, and this morning we're looking in on two of the disciples of Jesus, James and John. These are a couple of rugged fellows. If you were to see them, you'd say they're a couple of backwoodsy guys. James and John had all the appearances of a couple of fellows who had spent their young adult lives working in the sun, tending to nets and casting for fish, and their hands were covered with the calluses that proved their trade. And this morning, they've managed somehow to create a private meeting with Jesus, just the three of them, James and John and Jesus. And James, the older, John, the younger, have an agenda. They have an audacious request that they want to make of Jesus this morning. Master, grant us that we might sit one at your right and one at your left in your glory. You can't fault these two fellows for not having any ambition. All that they're asking is that at the time of the consummation of the kingdom of God, when Jesus is recognized as the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, when all of the nations recognize his authority and power, all that they're asking is that they'll get to see it sit on the two best spots on the bus, one on his right and one on his left, and to share in his authority and power. All they're asking is that of all of the people of the world, they'll get to sit on his right and on his left. And oh, by the way, all that they're asking is that of all of the disciples, the 12 inner circle, they will be the two who will get the places of honor. This, folks, this is an unbelievable request that they're making. They, of course, do not understand what they're asking. As they lay awake at night, their minds are filled with visions of the things to come. They know that Jesus has been moving closer and closer to Jerusalem. They know that Jerusalem is the seat of power in Israel. They know, or at least they believe that they know, that at the time of the coming of God's kingdom, Jerusalem will be the center of all things. And it will be the center of all power. And they've been laying awake at night. They've been wondering, as Jesus moves closer and closer to Jerusalem, they've been wondering, is it coming? Is it coming? Is the day coming when Jesus is going to put an army together and he's going to overthrow the Roman Empire? Is it coming this week? But they have no idea what they're asking. Jesus says so. You don't understand what you're asking of me today, he says. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink? Are you able to be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized? Notice, he's speaking in the present tense. The cup and the baptism are symbolic references to suffering, and for Jesus, the suffering has already started. He knows what's coming. And every day is filled with greater and greater awareness that the time is almost here. The shadow of the cross is already spreading across them. But they don't understand. James and John are like a couple of young soldiers who are going off to war filled with great big visions of what they're going to accomplish and imagining that all will be glory, and they don't understand. Yes, We're ready to drink the cup you drink and to be baptized with the baptism that you are baptized with. And Jesus says, you will be. You will be. But deferring, as he always does, to the will of his Father, Jesus said, it is not up to me to grant your request of one of you to sit at my right and one at my left at the time of the glory. That has been determined by a source, a different source. The disciples of Jesus, James and John, wander off. Shoot, what are they thinking? It doesn't hurt to ask, right? They wander back toward the other 10, and somehow or another, the other 10 have caught word of what's been going on in this private little conversation. Maybe they had been overhearing. Maybe they'd been standing close enough. Maybe one of them had stood near enough to listen in on the conversation. Somehow or another, they know, and when James and John get back to the circle of the 10 remaining disciples, they are livid. Mark says they are indignant. Wouldn't you have loved to have heard that conversation? What? You take Jesus aside for a private meeting to talk about who will get to sit on his right hand and his left. Did you ever think about the way that would impact the rest of us community? Good heavens, at least we could have had this as a public conversation. We could have debated with one another to see who deserves to sit on the right and on the left. We could have had a good, civil, democratic conversation. Because as we all know, democratic conversations are always civil. And Jesus, aware of this conversation, moves back to his disciples, and he says, you know that those who are regarded as rulers, by the way, interesting phrasing, those who are regarded as rulers may indicate that they think they are, but they're not really. Those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority of them. It will not be so among you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. They have heard this before, of course. They had heard this just a week or two previously, almost the exact same words from Jesus. They'd heard it before again and again. In fact, in the Gospel of Mark, this is not the first time that Jesus has spoken about servanthood, second, third. This is the 8,489,000th time that Jesus has spoken to his disciples about service. James and John come with what they think is an audacious request, but it is Jesus whose request is stronger. If you want to be great, then serve. You know, I've been in the church for a very long time now. I've been in the church a good part of my life. I have no idea how many times I have read this passage of Scripture or others like it in the New Testament. I'm going to guess possibly hundreds of times that I've read the New Testament's emphasis upon service. Greatness equals service. I've sat in on dozens and dozens of sermons in which this same theme has been spoken about. Leadership equals service. I suspect that you too have sat in on dozens of Bible studies and conversations and Sunday school classes and worship services and sermons in which the theme of this worship has been greatness equals service. There have been times when I've sat in on sermons and Sunday school classes and small group studies when this theme comes up and I begin to wander off in my mind and I say things to myself like, that's nice. That's a nice topic that we're covering today. But have you ever stopped and wondered why it was that Jesus repeated these words so many times? Why it was that Paul picked them up in his language in the other New Testament letters, why it is that literally dozens of occasions throughout the New Testament, this emphasis of leadership as service, greatness as becoming the slave of all, comes up again and again and again and again. Could it possibly be that Jesus and his early followers understood that it's because this message of servanthood is competing in our world with a very different message about what leadership is? Diane, I'm going to ask you to pull up a little quote that I came across here recently in my reading. This was a little quote that I came across. I think you'll find it interesting. a contemporary writer writing about business and so forth, said, "Leadership is the art of getting others to do what you want them to do, when you want it done, and to the standards that you set." Isn't that nice? So if I'm a leader in my home, all I have to do is to get Dawn to do what I want her to do, when I want her to do it, and to the standards that I set, as though that could ever happen. By this definition of leadership, Adolf Hitler was a brilliant leader. By this definition of leadership, Joseph Stalin was an incredible leader. But set these words now beneath the words of Jesus. Let's look at them again, if you'd pull those up. Jesus said, "You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them. They get them to do what they want, when they want them to do it, according to the standards that they set. And their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be slave of all." Let's put them together on the same screen so that we just see them together. Leadership, the art of getting others to do what you want them to do, when you want it done, and to the standards you set. Leadership, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant and must be the slave of all. Do you get the impression that there's a difference in these two messages? I wonder if it's possible that the reason that Jesus said this again and again and again, and Paul the Apostle wrote it again and again and again, is because this message of what greatness is stands in such dramatic and powerful contrast to what we see and hear and are taught every day. This morning, I'm going to make two requests of you. I'm going to ask, first of all, that you don't check out. We know this message. We have it memorized. We've heard it dozens and dozens of times before, at least most of us have. This morning, I'm going to ask that you not say to yourself, "Oh, that's nice," and then go off into daydream world with whatever it is that you want to be thinking about. This morning, would you lean in and listen to the word of Jesus as though you're hearing it for the very first time? These are revolutionary words. Would you just lean in and really, really listen to what Jesus is saying? That's the first thing that I'm going to ask of you this morning. And the second thing I'm going to ask of you this morning is I'm going to ask you to listen to his call to service in light of the theme that we are considering this fall, a theme about radical hospitality. I believe that one of the ways that Christian people can practice the sort of leadership that Jesus is describing, servant leadership, is through the practice of hospitality. And this morning, I want to ask you to think about servanthood in light of a particular kind of hospitality, the hospitality that we offer in our neighborhoods to the people who live close to us, the people who live around us in the places where we live. I believe that this is extraordinarily timely today. I believe that one of the things that Christian people can do as servant leaders in our neighborhoods is the simple practice of hospitality, because it's being lost as an art, I believe, within our culture. I believe we have an opportunity to serve as leaders in this process once again. And I believe that one of the fundamental places that we practice this art of hospitality is simply where we live. And I'm aware that we live in very different places. There are some of us here this morning that live out in the country and that live on farms. And you judge the distance between you and your neighbor by acres. And there are others of us who live in the inner city, gang-infested, mega-urban multiplex of places like Alma and Ithaca and St. Louis. Some of us live in apartments where we measure the distance between us and our neighbor by a wall. Some of us live in a neighborhood where it's 30 or 40 feet between our homes. I'm going to ask you to just bring to mind the place where you live, and ask the question, What would it look like to practice the servanthood of hospitality in your neighborhood? And I want to tell you about two of the finest hosts that I have ever known, and they happen to be my parents. You'll forgive me this morning, I hope, by telling you some family stories. My family moved to Casper, Wyoming in 1964. This would have put it about 20 years before I was born. And we lived in the city. If you picture Wyoming being nothing but miles and miles of nothing but miles and miles, you have most of it. But where I lived was actually a city, Casper. And I lived in a very average neighborhood. And my family moved into this neighborhood in 1964. Now, I didn't ever think anything of this as a kid, but this is the way it worked at my house. Whenever there were big events, holidays like Thanksgiving or Easter, there was always a house full of people in my home. My parents knew everybody that lived on the block. They knew both sides of the street, this busy street that I grew up on. They knew all the people on both sides of the street on the block that we lived on, plus many others who lived around in other areas not too far away. Thanksgiving and Easter every year, there would be a house full of people. Now, I don't want to give the impression that this happened all the time. It was just two or three times a year. There were a house full of people. There was the lady who lived to the right of our house, Mrs. Watts. She was a divorcee who lived on her own. She didn't have any place to go, so she was at our house for Thanksgiving. And Mr. Popple, who lived on the left, after his wife passed away, and he was a widower, my parents had him over to their house. And his parents, who were much older, who lived down at the end of the block, they would come down and they would join us. And every week, family and local neighbors would gather together in this neighborhood. And my parents just knew everybody by name. They would just constantly walk around and talk to people, and they knew them by name. There was a family across the way who were very troubled, violent teenagers, constantly in trouble. My parents knew them by name. When those teenage boys would walk past our house, my parents would walk outside and speak to them by name. And when my parents were out on walks, they would stop and they would talk to these very angry, violent boys. We didn't ever have any trouble with them because there was a relationship that my parents had developed with these boys. We didn't ever have any trouble with them whatsoever. There was a girl, a special needs girl who lived across the alley. Heather was her name, and Heather would come over, and she would pound on our back door. She would walk through the back gate, through our backyard, and she didn't knock on the door. She pounded. You always knew it was Heather. The whole house would shake when Heather showed up, and my mother would open the door, and she would say, "Heather, I'm so glad you're here." And if she had some cookies, she would offer Heather some cookies and a glass of milk, and she'd sit down and talk, and this didn't take hours. It took minutes. Literally, after 5 minutes, my mom would often say, "Well, Heather, I have a lot of things that I need to do today, so it's time for you to go home now." And Heather wouldn't think twice about it. She would get up, and she would walk back to her home. There was an uncle of my dad's, a great uncle actually, by the name of Irv, that when we moved to Wyoming, my dad found out through the grapevine that his great uncle was living somewhere in Casper. He was a loner, had been a loner for years and years, and so my dad followed one lead after another until he finally found Uncle Irv living in really what was a slum. And my parents helped Uncle Irv to get out of this slum that he lived in, and they helped him to move into a clean apartment. He was 90 years old when they found him. And every Sunday, without exception, my parents would go pick up Uncle Irv after church, and they would bring him home, and we'd have roast beef and mashed potatoes and all kinds of goodies, and he would tell us his stories, and he did this until he died about 5 years later. This was the home that I grew up in, and I'm humbled by it because it's much better than my own practice of hospitality. But this was the home in which I grew up, and I believe I can say very neutrally, very objectively, the neighborhood in which I lived was better and safer because of the kind of hospitality that my parents practiced in the community. Neighbors knew one another because they were connected through my parents. Well, we're thinking this morning about hospitality as the practice of servant greatness. I wonder how many of you have ever heard this story. A little boy was drawing something or another on a blank sheet of paper, and And as he was doing his drawing, his mother came up to him and she said, "Johnny, what are you drawing?" And Johnny said, "I'm drawing God." And his mother, a good theologian, said, "Johnny, nobody knows what God looks like." And Johnny said, "Well, they will now." I wonder how many of the disciples of Jesus, if they were to draw an image of God, they would have been reluctant to do this because they were Jewish, and Jews have always been very reluctant to draw images of God. But I wonder how many of the disciples of Jesus, if they were to draw an image of God, would have drawn a servant host as their primary image of God. I suspect, at least early on, none of them would have. I suspect that they would have drawn images of conqueror kings, rulers and authorities, people who looked very much like Caesar of their day. That's my guess. But they should have known better. And they should have known better because of what they had seen in Jesus. They should have remembered the day when Jesus called them. They should have remembered that day when Jesus invited Peter and Andrew and James and John, the very two James, the same James and John as the subjects of this passage, when he called them and he said, "Come follow me, and I will make you fishers of men." And it was an invitation to a mentoring relationship with Jesus, to learn to walk in the way of the Spirit from Jesus. But it was also an invitation to be part of his community. The doors were open and they were welcomed. Do you hear the hospitality of this? Jesus was inviting them to live with him. He was inviting them to go camping with him. He was inviting them to be on the way with him. He was inviting them to sit around the campfire and to pass gas and to laugh about it together with him. Jesus was inviting disciples to be part of the community together with him. They should have known that if they were going to draw an image of God, that their image should be a servant host because of the way he had invited Levi, the tax collector. The man among them who, for the most obvious reasons, had no business being with them, this hated tax collector whom Jesus had invited in exactly the same way as all the rest of them. "Levi, follow me. Join my community. Be part of what I am a part of. Walk in the way with me. I am your host." They should have known, based on what he had taught them to do with one another. I've told you this many, many times. Among the followers of Jesus was Levi the tax collector and Simon the zealot. They could not have been further apart on the political spectrum. They could not have been further apart. And yet, by his act of playing host to both of them, he was teaching them to play host to one another. They should have known by all of the interactions that Jesus had with people that they were part of on a regular basis. When the woman pressed through the crowd and she pressed through all the people to reach out and touch his robe because she had had a flow of blood for 12 years. For 12 years she had been ill and she had not been able to get any comfort from any of the doctors. And because of the nature of her illness that she had a flow of blood for 12 years, she was not welcome in the synagogues. She was unhosted to the temple. She could not be part of the community. She was separated from all of the resources of people because, according to Jewish law, she was ritually impure. And when Jesus, perceiving that someone had touched him and that energy had gone from him, turned around and asked this question, who she was, this woman, who she was, and she explained her need, and he said, "Woman, go your way. Your faith has made you whole." Do they understand, the disciples of Jesus, what is happening here? She is welcomed to the resources of God's power and God's love, and she belongs and she's part. He is the servant host who is traveling among them and welcoming the people. And if they didn't understand it, as a result of all of these things that they had seen and heard and witnessed and touched and felt in all the time that they had been with Jesus, they should have understood today because of the final words that Jesus says in this text of Scripture, the very last words in this teaching to these disciples. Jesus said, "Even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." It will just be days now, just a matter of days, that Jesus will go to the cross, and the greatest transaction in all of history is going to take place. The greatest transformation in all of history is going to take place just in a matter of days. all of the evil, wicked, horrific energy that puts Jesus on the cross, all of the hatefulness, all of the inhospitality of the world that puts him on the cross will be transformed by the cross into grace and into love and into welcome. And everyone who stands on this side of the cross is welcomed in his name. The disciples will finally understand this following the resurrection. Ah! throughout the world, throughout all of history, all civilizations have drawn out their little images of what God or their gods look like. And throughout all history, the warrior king, the conqueror, the rulers have won the day. And the tombs of the Egyptians and the Syrophoenicians and the Syrians, the pictures of power represent the different gods whom they worship. Until the first century, until the days following the resurrection, Christians started going around and started etching in walls little crosses here and here and here and over in the catacombs over here. They just started etching little crosses. This little symbol of servant love. This little symbol of God's hospitality that has welcomed the community of faith in, not because of what they have done or not because of what they've accomplished or not because of who they are, but because they have received and welcomed and entrusted themselves to this grace. Would you let your imagination go loose for just a moment? What would happen if a church of people who had been infected by that kind of grace and infected by that kind of hospitality were to go back to our neighborhoods, whether those neighborhoods are a farmhouse separated by acres from the next farmhouse or an apartment complex separated by a wall from the next family? What would happen if a church of people who had been infected by this grace and by this servant hospitality went back into their communities and infected their communities with the same kind of hospitality? I wonder, over the course of many years, what would happen in the communities in which those people live. It would take many years. I do know that for a church, for churches, for Christian people to do such a thing, there would be two movements that would be necessary. The first movement would be that those Christians would need to move inward again and again and again and again every day to that place where hospitality happens, like the stethoscope that we saw earlier. That group of people would need to go inward every day to the place where, by the grace and power and love of God, they are welcomed. You see, what we do when we pray, we certainly may intercede for one another, and we certainly may reach out through our prayers. But I hope the first thing that we do when we pray is to return to the table where we are welcomed. Welcome. You are my son or my daughter. You are welcomed because of the cross of Jesus. You are welcome. And then, having made that move inward every day, those people begin to move outward into their neighborhoods. I just wonder what it would look like. It probably would take less time than you think. They would probably, they'd probably get to know the names of the people who live on the streets or the neighborhoods around them. They would probably try to remember their children and remember their children's names. They would probably try to be aware of who some of the people in that community with special needs are, perhaps someone who is widowed, or maybe a single mom who is struggling, or a single dad who is struggling to take care of their children. They would probably want to be particularly aware of some of those people who are sort of dispossessed. And maybe a couple of times a year, they would want to open up their homes and welcome some of these people into their homes to enjoy what is still in every culture the most powerful symbol of fellowship that we offer, which is eating together a meal that we have prepared together. It would probably look like people knowing and observing and looking and being open and welcoming. And I just wonder what it would look like if in this church, we who have been infected by the grace of God We're to practice that sort of servant hospitality in our neighborhoods. You're already doing it. I wonder what would happen if we grew an even greater vision for doing it even more. Well, how about we find out together over the next several years what it looks like when hospitality happens? Would you pray with me, please?